Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
Yeah. Hi, this is Jeff Ordauer. I am the executive director of Global Exchange.
And so we're talking, it's now August. That means we're in month 8 of hashtag resistance. And I think the last time we actually were in the same place was a big healthcare rally, I think right before the inauguration, right? So that puts you in a good place for me to ask you the obnoxious question of, like, how do you think we're doing so far?
I think we're doing pretty well, all things considered. Yes, I think it was right after the inauguration that all the Republicans met in Philly.
Right, yes.
I'm trying to remember the exact date. And I think it was around the 23rd or 24th of January. And it was a pretty impressive, you know, measure of resistance. And I think we're doing well. I mean, we're not winning, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think we're doing better than, you know, I would have anticipated. I mean, when you think about, right, Obamacare still exists.
Yeah.
Richard Cordray has not been fired yet. You know, I remember being on vacation with some folks who work in fighting for Wall Street reform, and they were making plans to, you know, what the response to his firing that they thought was going to happen imminently on Trump. And even some smaller things around financial reform, like it is entirely possible that the arbitration rule is going to stay in effect, which will give the new arbitration rule from the Obama administration, which will give folks the right to sue, for example, Wells Fargo, that tells you opens your fraudulent account and then uses that money to sell you fraudulent auto insurance on that loan. So I actually think, you know, things are in some ways better than we could have imagined.
Yeah.
And that's just in large part, you know, thanks to the amazing work of the resistance that so many people have just sort of stepped forward. And I think many people who have not been active before and done, and then smart organizers have figured out how to harness that energy, whether that's bringing hundreds of people in mass arrest or giving people a really solid program for saying, if you're going to your congressperson's office, here's how you create an alternative town hall, or here's how you bring a handwritten letter, or how, so creating containers and vehicles where folks who are pretty new can be activated and do something that's really relevant. I think that's pretty inspiring. So I think we're doing all right.
Yeah.
That can all change momentarily when, you know, if there's a terrorist attack or we preemptively invade somewhere. I think war changes the footing of everything and unfortunately changes what's possible in terms of overall repression.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just from my perch as the director of Global Exchange, the other worrisome thing is, you know, coups or the shrinking of rights are just so possible around the world. There's so many templates for this, whether that's a sort of a quasi-legal coup in Brazil, or whether that's the president of the Philippines engaging in mass extrajudicial killings, or whether that's the Poles, where all the roots of, you know, a lot of the roots of white supremacy are in Eastern Europe, where they're figuring out how to ignore the courts and just do whatever they want to do as a government. So I think those are the worries.
Yeah.
And then added to the fact, Wall Street, things on Wall Street are booming, the rich are getting richer, and you know, white supremacy and misogyny is running rampant. So to say we're doing okay because we're not losing as much ground as we thought doesn't change the material conditions if you're a person of color or, you know, a woman in this country.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of different, as we were saying before we turned the recorder on, there's just a lot of different pieces moving at any given time. And it's hard to sort of know where to focus sometimes. And like, so the healthcare thing obviously took center stage for most of the last several months, ultimately successfully, whereas, you know, some other things maybe didn't get as much front and center, you know, attention. But I think, so before we move on from healthcare, because we are talking about, right, this was a thing that people immediately reacted and said, we've got to actually stop cuts to Medicaid. We've got to stop them, you know, overturning the ACA. And because of that immediate recognition that this was a place they were going to attack, really managed to get a lot of good work done. And so, you know, I guess my question to you is what are the lessons that you're taking from how that went down for the other fights that everybody now has to pivot to?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Sarah. I've been grappling with that myself. I think what I said earlier, that at the risk of being repetitive, I think it's, I mean, one, there's, you know, like anything, the story is really critical. And so uprisings and movements happen because something, you know, something horrible happened or something that affects people is going to happen, right? So there's, you know, they're going to take away, they're going to poison the water on indigenous lands and Standing Rock, or, you know, there's yet another sort of police massacre in cold blood, or there's people who are worried about their health care and what's going to happen to them, and more importantly, what's going to happen to their children. Mm-hmm. So I think that's like really important, and that can't be underestimated as a starting place. And so how we tell that story and who's affected and putting effect and having affected people take the biggest and boldest risk in being in the front is critical. Mm-hmm. But I think on the technical and clinical side of organizing, it really is, I think a lot of times as organizers, we sometimes fall into the trap where we want to have the perfect thing. Mm-hmm. Either it's the perfect narrative. So I'm saying the story, the perfect story or the perfect, like I know in the early days of the healthcare fight, for example, people were like, well, you need to, if you want to move McCain, you have to get 7 veterans to go to McCain's office.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we try to be too strategic, mm-hmm. and really, it's like people want to move. We got to give them something to do, and we got to give them something to do that makes sense that they can also do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's, you know, occupying a park or putting your bodies on the line. And sometimes that's just like show up with a handwritten letter. Here's your toolkit for organizing this alternative town hall. And so I think creating those containers where everyone can take action is really, really important. Yeah. And particularly new people that they feel they can see themselves. It's no different than when I was first training as an ACORN organizer back in the day in the 90s, and you sit on someone's couch and you're talking about neighborhood issues.
Right.
And the way people were going to get involved or not, even if you're saying, well, what do you think it would take to get a stop sign on the corner? And they would say, I don't know, we got to get some people in the street. And you're like, well, how many people would it take to block the street? Like 30. And you say, well, great, could you be one of those 30? And if they could see themselves doing that, then they were going to join. And if they thought it didn't make sense, they wouldn't. And so I think creating just things that people can see themselves doing and then doing is really, really critical to all the fights. And, you know, what that ask is different. It's not always an easy thing to do, right? People will go and be in the streets, as we saw in, you know, from St. Louis, as we saw in Ferguson, night after night after night, because they felt like that was the most important thing that they could do. But they can see, as long as they can see themselves doing that thing.
So when you're saying, of course, something happened or something is going to happen, and you mentioned financial reform, so I want to sort of look back at the last many years now since the financial crisis, which was obviously the thing that has happened that is still shaking up politics, not just in the U.S., but all over the world. And, you know, Trump sort of very notably ran criticizing Hillary Clinton's Wall Street ties, Ted Cruz's Wall Street ties, everybody and their mother's Wall Street ties. But as you said, Wall Street's making tons of money and they're all over the Trump administration. And so is financial reform, are some of these issues making a point about Trump's Wall Street connections when he said that he didn't have them? Is that a good place to put some of the energy now that the healthcare thing is somewhat on the back burner?
So yes, but people are going to move on what they're going to move on.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it is interesting. The pernicious effects of finance capital are so apparent, right? And you think about a Goldman Sachs, that folks have been fighting them on government Sachs, like they would have been running the Clinton administration or the Trump administration. And it is sort of fascinating to think it's an organization that can accommodate as alumni, you know, Steve Bannon and Gary Cohn. How smart is that? That like pretty much anyone who's governing, and there would have been a separate set of Goldman Sachs folks who would have gone into the Clinton administration. So, yeah, I mean, it is the right place to spend resources. And if you do your power research, you can sort of trace things, not just in this country, but globally as well, right? The public-private partnerships that a Goldman Sachs is doing, or that a Blackstone is doing, where they're trying to get $40 billion with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to privatize, to build infrastructure and privatize it all. That's real, and we need to be fighting it. And then these are the same institutions that are, for example, floating police bonds or charging cities exorbitant rates so that when their police murder people, they cannot make those payments. So it's an intersectional fight. I think we have to do a better job of getting folks to see that. I think people feel it in their gut, but then it's like less clear what they can do. Mm-hmm. And I think where this has worked well, for example, in solidarity with Standing Rock, there were hundreds and hundreds of actions against Wells Fargo and big cities, you know, New York, Philadelphia, Seattle, all pulling their funds from Wells Fargo because of the financing and sort of the power behind the specific wrong. Mm-hmm. So I think folks are there, and we need to just have harder hitting campaigns, harder hitting messaging about that. And also, I think it cuts to the heart. There's a nascent socialism that is emerging, and so the more we can name capitalism, finance capital as the enemy, the more folks are going to want to join in that fight. Yeah. So I think all of those things are important. Operationally, where it's tricky is as an organizing sector, or as it has been traditionally easy for us to have a campaign and have specific demands. And in some cases, that's like, how do we save the ACA, do these things, and we can stop bad things from happening?
Right.
Or there have been campaigns around how we change particular aspects of corporate behavior. Mm-hmm. We need a different model for taking on corporate power, and we don't really have that. Occupy was interesting around that because it told the story.
Right.
I don't think the banks feared the message, but I don't think they feared that, you know, the Occupy movement was going to take down the banks. So it's something sort of in between just telling the story, mm-hmm. sophisticated campaigns where we're trying to change a piece of behavior. Like, we needed to have a fundamental conflict with the Blackstones, with the Goldmans, with the Wells Fargos of the world, but we don't really have a good model for doing that. And that's the thing we got to figure out.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. We're talking tonight is the first night of the Democratic Socialists of America conference. We're talking on a Thursday. And yeah, there's now 25,000 people who are paid up members of one particular socialist organization. There's others that have also grown since this election. And interestingly, not just since Bernie Sanders, but since Trump's election, again, people seem to be looking for a more sort of coherent ideological place to be organizing, and not just still in the communities and still in your neighborhood and still around specific campaigns, but to have a thing that says, like, actually capitalism is the problem. So I wonder, you know, after your years of organizing in different places and in different sort of vehicles for organizing, you know, what do you see as different in the way people are organizing themselves now?
Yeah, I think we are right. So we're naming capitalism in a way that we haven't named before. And I think that's vital and critical. And so shall we say, like, I was raised, my generation of organizers, so I'm in my mid-40s, was sort of raised and mentored by the baby boomers. And a lot of the baby boomers who went into the nuts and bolts of organizing were non-ideological, because they saw that as a reaction to the 60s and, you know, where there was a lot of ideological groups or a lot of people who didn't want to go and do the hard work of building organization and building a base. And so they tended to be distrustful of that. And so we were raised kind of without an ideology. Mm-hmm. And therefore we didn't talk about those things. And I think that hurt us, at least a subset of organizers. There were a set of organizers always talking about that, but I think the vast majority who moved into the networks and into labor were not publicly sort of talking about vision, talking about ideology, and so that hurt us, and that's exciting to see the next generation really, really talking about socialism, really talking about capitalism. That's such an amazing thing, and I think it opens up a lot more freewheeling conversation. And so I think where we go next sometimes is it would be exciting. Again, I feel like we are starting to get there. So yeah. If you take, let's say, the Movement for Black Lives Vision platform that really articulates the world in which we want to live, that's amazing. And that should be a North Star for all of us. Then we can talk about how we get there. But I think there's more we're putting out utopias, if you will, the more we can really start to, and then we can start to talk to real people about what it might mean to have free education, or even what it might mean to not have the police, or what it might mean to not have banks, or, you know, is basic income on the table? Is a livable wage on the table? Is a guaranteed right to housing? So all of those things, I think, fit kind of the world in which we want to live, and it's good that we're starting to get there. And then again, that gets back to the question of what's the best way to achieve the changes that we want.
Yeah.
But it's exciting that all of that's on the table now and that we're moving into that era.
Yeah, and it's been a really, I'm thinking about the Vision for Black Lives platform as you brought that up. And this way that people are now saying we need to actually have a platform, we need to have goals, despite the fact that the Democratic Party seems not to want to pick up any of the things that are floating around there that have been coming out of different movements, but we'll leave that alone for now. But you were in St. Louis when Ferguson began, when the uprising there took the country by storm. And there haven't been that kind of big sort of spontaneous uprisings around police violence in the last few months, but people are doing, you know, are organizing on the ground in all sorts of interesting ways. So I'm wondering if you have some thoughts on where that movement is right now.
Yeah, I think there's just so much, you know, vibrant and sophisticated organizing. I guess I might take that question in a slightly different direction, which is we need both. So we need sophisticated campaign-style organizing.
Yeah.
Actually, we need three things. We need real electoral work with VITE. And I think we're very drawn to candidate work.
Yeah.
But we actually have a lot of power with ballot initiatives at the local and the state level. To be pretty disruptive, to be pretty aspirational. There could be ballot initiatives around abolishing the police or around basic income at the local level or even in some states that are interesting and intriguing. You know, there's smaller states and lower signature thresholds. So I think we're underutilizing that.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, your point on uprisings, though, is we don't invest as a sector in creating containers, like what is the thing that Standing Rock and Occupy and Ferguson all had in common, and the thing in the Wisconsin Capitol? I think all of which are in your book, most of them.
Well, Standing Rock is not, but I did go there, so.
That's right. I last seen you, I last saw you when you got back from Standing Rock.
Yes.
So what they all have in common is that people showed up and then they didn't go home.
Yeah.
And I think we need to try to do more of those kinds of things, because there aren't that many of those things that we're trying, where people are there and they're willing to stay there and fight it out.
Yeah.
And if we can do that, then we're going to see more disruptions. Not all of them are going to work, because not all of anything in organizing works.
Yeah.
But the resources that we spend on sophisticated campaign work vastly outweigh, or sort of, you know, parsing the political moment, vastly outweigh what we spend on really trying to create disruptions.
Yeah.
And I think that's super important, that we really spend some resources and try and force some more conflicts.
Yeah.
So that's a little bit where I'm, and that isn't to take anything away from, because it's such a rich fabric of really sophisticated, you know, and anti-police campaigns, around minimum wage campaigns, and we're coming closer and closer together to where, like, I feel like 20 years ago or 10 years ago even, sort of the gap between folks who saw things as, you know, this is intersectionality is real. People saw things as a feminist issue, people saw things as a structural racism or people saw things as class didn't intersect and didn't talk to each other.
Yeah.
And now I think what's exciting about this sort of anti-capitalist moment is also a desire for the work to be much more intersectional, thinking about Show Me 15 working with choice groups and being a racial justice organization very deliberately, Show Me 15 being the Missouri component of the Fight for 15 in St. Louis, like those are the kinds of things that are really, really interesting and important.
Yeah. And I think, there are moments where it becomes really obvious, right? Like in the middle of Congress being about to vote on a healthcare bill that would take healthcare away from millions of people, Donald Trump comes out and makes a big fuss about how the military is not going to allow transgender people anymore because their healthcare is too expensive, basically. And to see these things, not as this is a distraction from that, but actually this is the sort of full scale assault on all of us, and certain people become the most targeted, but if they're coming for you in the morning, they'll be coming for us in the evening, as they say, right?
That's right.
On some level, it helps bring people together, but then it also, it can be hard, right? There is a lot of this conversation right now about, like, is this a distraction from that? Is this a distraction from, Russia or whatever we're supposed to be paying attention to? So I guess to make a question out of that, what's, advice that you've from, again, recent or longer term work that you've been doing on how to sort of beat that argument that people will say this is divisive or this is a distraction, if it affects a certain marginalized group?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. So, I was in central Pennsylvania a couple of months ago. With folks, there's this great project, Small Towns Rising, that was helping make organizing materials available to lots and lots of folks. And you would hear people be like, "Oh no, we have to fight immigration here, and healthcare here, and financial reform here, and what are we going to do? And it's too many things." Yeah. But there's a fundamental question, and it is about systemic change, and it's about. Now, I don't know what that looks like, whether that's not just getting rid of Trump-Pence, right? That's a more fundamental change. Maybe that's changing our structure of government and how we work. Maybe that's just creating within an existing framework a different kind of thing. Like, it is interesting, thinking about what's going on in Venezuela, right or wrong right now, they're writing a new constitution.
Yeah.
There's lots of problems with how that's working. But I think we need to think about fundamentally, the system is working the way it's designed to do. It isn't working to help people. It was a constitution written by landowning white men. And so what do we need to do to change things up and change the equation, make a very different world, and change this regime more fundamentally? And I think that's a conversation that then connects the dots. And I'll tell a little bit of a story about this. Mm-hmm. About 10 years ago now, I was in Bolivia. So it's a few years after Evo Morales had been elected, and we were meeting with some groups who had helped write the new constitution.
Yeah.
And they said that they had included LGBTQ issues in the new constitution, not just this was 2005 or 2006, not just non-discrimination on sexual orientation, but also on gender identity. And this is a country that and maybe had like a handful of out sort of queer activists. And so why did they do that? They did that because there was a left government and because, important forces asked them to do that. And then later on, a couple of days later in La Paz, I went to like the most amazing drag show I've ever been to in my life that was held at a city hall, like one of the neighborhood city halls of La Paz, because the government had enshrined this right to non-discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. And so the deputy mayor came out and was at this drag show. And as was, the women's group of the neighborhood, as was the queer community of La Paz. And it was like this, I sort of had this is what it's like after the revolution moment. Because if you really have governing power, folks get it. Folks get how things fit together. And if you have governing power, you can change things fundamentally. And I think we're still trying to win on our issues, and we're not thinking about how we peacefully, nonviolently, but with enough force, do the things we need to do to disrupt the systems in a way that we can change everything for everyone and that it's interconnected. And that isn't to say we ignore issues till the revolution happens,
right?
But it is to say that we think much more strategically about governing power that is very different than the system. And in some ways, it is a little bit what the Trump, what some folks in the Trump administration are trying to do from the other side,
right?
As well.
Yeah, and that's a real, you know, a thing that I think the center is still sort of struggling to grapple with, that like there is no place you can get back to where we're just going to be in sort of two-party stability at this point. Like, they're playing this game to win and to bring about the sort of, you know, the end of history we were all promised after the end of the Soviet Union, that this is not, you know, a party that wants to just get back to Democrats and Republicans alternate the presidency every 8 years and, you know, there are bipartisan bills. That's out the window, whether we like it or not right now.
Yeah, and so we can sort of have upheaval, and it can be like France, where neither of those two parties are left, neither two parties are left in government, but what you have is a new party that is centrist, that is equally centrist and corporate.
Yeah, and that is now rivaling Trump in approval ratings already.
Yeah, already. True. Or we can be, you know, trying to build a left project. And I think lots of people are trying to do that, and that's what's exciting. And I hope we can push ourselves to continue to go out. Like, I think we believe this in our hearts and our heads, and so the question is, and it's a struggle for me too, how do you move sufficiently outside the existing system while still understanding that the things you do in the system really make a difference, right? To say, oh, we're only going to deal with things until we have governing. We're not going to deal with things until we have governing power. Well, that takes away the fact that if we can have 22 million people keep their health care, that makes a real difference.
Yeah.
And I think it's a trick of how we hold both, but at least we need to be thinking about both at the same time.
Yeah. On some level, I think, just to bring this back around to wind up with something that's a little bit more concrete, but still, as they say, utopian, a single-payer healthcare fight does seem like a good place to flex those muscles, because to win it, you're not going to just have to get lawmakers to agree to pass laws. You're going to have to defeat really powerful, very well-financed corporate entities.
Yeah. I wonder sometimes what's interesting about that strategically, and it is the fight that has legs right now, so I don't want to take the legs out from under the fight. Not that what I'm doing on a podcast interview, if you would do that. But the healthcare companies rule a piece of the world and are making a buck, but are also willing to cut deals when necessary, right? A lot of the part of why the ACA passed was because a significant number of insurance companies were willing to, you know, had a certain price that they could meet to support it, as opposed to fighting global finance capital and the way in which they're involved in every single piece of, you know, the destruction of the planet or the incarceration complex or, you know, migrant detention and deportation machine and everything else that they're doing and funding police foundations. So I wonder if it might be the right fight. It might not. But it is a place to flex our muscles if we could do that and if we could win. So based on, you know, you think about how close folks came in California, how close people came in Vermont, or won in Vermont and then lost in Vermont. Like, there's a lot of potential to really see concrete wins, and so that is the appeal. I think on strategy, you hate to just sort of say, oh, this isn't perfect, make the perfect the enemy of the good.
Yeah.
So it is a fight for which there's a lot of momentum. And then also it really does create a fight for the heart and soul of the Democratic Party in a very clear-cut way, mm-hmm. That I think no one else has, you know, there's no other issue that is doing that in quite the same way. presuming that is that the anti-choice folks aren't going to come back in the Democratic Party in a significant way.
Yeah.
So I guess as I'm talking, I'm saying yes, and we should also think about how we keep the fight against Wall Street alive, because that is about building a global movement for solidarity that seems really, really necessary, and our healthcare markets are much more domestically focused, and the world is intertwined, and I think we should be thinking about that as well.
Global solidarity is a good place to end, I think.
Yeah, so a bunch of Democrats, I think Kirsten Gillibrand just backed down from supporting this bill in its current form, but there's a bill being pushed through Congress that is getting bipartisan support that would criminalize the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement against Israel. And so since you have done work around this issue as well, talk about that and the horrifying effect it might have and what people can do to stop that.
Yeah, I think as a piece of background to start with, what's really fascinating about the current moment is anti-Semitism has now been delinked from Zionism. So you can be sort of the Bannon Gorka crew in the White House and be anti-Semitic, but before the State of Israel. So we should just put that on the table and be clear. And I think this is sort of a last gasp effort from the forces of, you know, the sort of pro-Israeli government forces to say, actually, if you say things against Israel, you're anti-Semitic, and nothing could be farther from the truth. So it's sort of a fascinating moment that is going to move very rapidly. Now, that doesn't change what's happening on the ground, but because, the Jewish establishment is so powerful right now, they are going to ram this bill through in so many places. There's now, I think, close to a majority of states have passed criminalization of boycott, divestment, sanctions. And that is, what can folks do to stop it? I think the ACLU, right? They don't always agree with them, but they're talking about it being a free speech issue.
Yeah.
That seems really, really important. And I also think sometimes legislation is passed when the poll numbers aren't moving your way. So you try to move things legislatively. And actually, this is going to change. And I also think what's going to be exciting is there's going to be people who are going to defy that ban. And we may see, and perhaps this is another thing, when we think about folks in the climate movement who are willing to go to prison because of work that they've done, not just to jail, I think we're going to see some of that around BDS as well. So I think this is a minor setback, but the overall whole is things are talked about. The repression is going to backfire. Folks should be trying to fight the BDS bills. But at the end of the day, this is going to put the BDS movement and really the movement for human rights more internationally much more in the forefront. And it's going to have unintended consequences for folks who are trying to tamp down on dissent.
So, excellent. How can people keep up with you and your work and whatever you're going to be doing next?
Well, that's a good question. I think folks should check out globalexchange.org. It's probably the most substantive piece of the work that I'm doing right now. And then also am involved with a lot of other wonderful organizations, including Rising Tide in North America and Showing Up for Racial Justice and Jewish Voice for Peace. So there's many. I think what's exciting about this time is there's so many wonderful groups doing so much sophisticated work, and it's really important to for folks to pick a couple different places where they want to put their energy, or one place that they're most passionate about. But I think there's no absolute right answer. So hopefully everyone will find the work that they want to do and get involved.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.